This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
It's wonderful to be with you today, Denise, to talk about industry and industry in Philadelphia and the role of the worker in the city. And I just wanted to have us recall that a few years ago when I filmed you, when we came here to film, that I had mentioned to you my factory exhibition and project, Vertical Urban Factory. And I told you of my interest in filming factory workers because I was kind of done so much on architecture, but really it was the worker who was important. And I mentioned this idea of how do we film factory workers to tell their story. And I remember that you were very interested in that, in hearing the worker's story. And I wondered if you could explain why that was so important to you. I think you even had an idea of going to the retirement homes of workers in Philadelphia to record them so that younger people would understand that. And why was that important to you?
It was fortuitous that you had that interest, because I'd been working quite hard at thinking about what to do about it, particularly since I'm an old person myself now and I haven't got energy for all the things I want to do. But I had, for a long while, even from childhood, we had an old friend in her 90s. My mother adored her, and when she was part of, she was an old Scotswoman, and what a character. So she was really part of my childhood, and the notion that you should be very interested in the lives of old people just seemed automatic to me. And then when we came to work in Miami Beach, as Barbara Kaplan put it, she said it's the final resting place of the New York garment workers. And those old people were very funny. They'd approach you wherever you are. Who are you and what are you doing here? And what's that for? And I remember David Feynman, who went to Penn, and Feinberg, and he was with us, he was on our team, and we were in fact trying to buy sugar cane for me to take home, because as an African I loved it. So this old woman walks up and she says, what's that for? Why are you buying that? She's got legs like that, like a little chicken's legs. And David says, well, you could make juice of it. And I interrupted him and I said, you take it home and give it to your children and your grandchildren in Philadelphia. She says, my grandchildren live in New York. And so it's that kind of picturesque repartee, which I felt very easy with. And I was fascinated by how they came to be there and what they were doing about staying there. And then they would be at our community meetings. Mm. And Steve Eisenhower told a wonderful story about there was a whole community, and they're deaf, so they don't hear very well, so they talk loudly. So he would hear all the comments that meant to be going on between them. And they were walking out, because these economists were so boring and all of that. And then Steve started, and he heard one old lady say to the other, you can come back now, Hilda, this one you'll understand. So finding a kind of a joyful repartee, I would manage wherever I could, if there were old people there, to start finding out why they were there and what they were doing and things like that. And then I came to realize that the resting place of the time when Philadelphia was the biggest heavy industry center of the world is old people who had those last jobs and are now living in retirement communities all over Montgomery County. And what a resource they are for people who do oral histories. Now I have other connections. I had a great long friendship with a very, very wonderful old man. He was a musicologist and his name was Charles Seeger. And he had a history of marching against World War I up Washington Avenue in San Francisco and marching against the Vietnam War all those years later. And so the Smithsonian was doing an oral history on him. Mm. And so I began to be very interested in how this happened and what he could tell. I began to realize all these factory workers, someone should be doing that. I was saying, should it be high school students? Should it be people in a program like History and Sociology of Science and Technology at Penn? That's an interesting program. There's one at Temple. So my mind was just going over it. But meanwhile, I was also talking to old people, and I came across one quite senile old man in one of those kind of outskirts homes for cheaper ones, which meant they weren't getting treated nicely. No, that's not a nice thing to see either. But he would, could someone lend me 50 cents? I have to get a bus back to West Philadelphia. Well, of course, the taxi, a cab, he said, for 50 cents. Well, that would have cost him nearer to $50 at that point.
So it was interesting to me, too, that SLOT, the nonprofit organization that's associated with the University of Pennsylvania, was an organization, too, that you had been talking with about this idea of how to document.
But I want to tell you what this old man said, because it was so picturesque. He was not talking to me. He was talking to someone else. And he said, my father told me, as a metal worker, you must have two jobs. In case the one goes, you will have the other. So at the demand of his father, he became a metal roof installer and also a worker in manufacturing in a factory. And then he goes on and he says, these engineers, they're very difficult people. And it's no use telling an engineer he made a mistake. He said, if you look carefully, quite often in one of the things that's made, you'll find two seams. And that's where the engineer made a mistake. And he'd fixed the one seam with another seam. You didn't have to tell him he made the mistake. He knew he made the mistake, and he also knew how to fix it. Well, it was such a nice kind of right into the workings of the thing. And I think that's something, to find a way to get that kind of information, which so much reminded me of architects' offices and what you can't tell architects and things like that. But I think that's, and then the next thing, I've done a lot of, we've done a lot of lab design for life sciences research. And so we're dealing with people doing abstract research and translational research, the two things. So applied research, and as an architect, you think very hard about how do I use research and how do I apply research and how do I be practical? And then I heard someone say, the real cost savings innovations come from research done on the factory floor by factory workers.
Exactly. So that's what I've been filming in the films that I did for SLOT and in Philadelphia.
I saw them.
Right. What is the role of the worker in the factory?
Yes.
And how they have impact on the design of the product or the method of production. And people don't realize that. People don't understand that the worker on the factory floor has a set of knowledge. Yes. And that is too.
I talked also with another old man, and he'd worked for one factory all his life. It was after the Great Depression, and he couldn't go to college. So he went into this factory, and there were the apprentices there. Then there's apprentice law, which is fascinating, like telling an apprentice to go to another office, branch office, and ask for a long wait. So he goes and asks for a long wait. And he sits, and half an hour later, nothing's happened. And then an hour later, and then 2 hours later. And then he says, you know, I did come in and ask for this thing. He said, you asked for a long wait, and you're getting it. And the kind of hazing. Well, this guy had been through all of that as an apprentice. And the owner of the firm, a famous guy, and he'd been to Penn, he was an engineer, and he was an artist. His great interest was the apprentices. So there was this education going on, which I think is very interesting.
So what about that? That was one idea that you had too, which was to have high school students interview the factory workers. And what do you feel is the value in that today?
Well, I feel, first of all, it might be very difficult because I think that the places where they're living would start putting up barriers. And they would say, you have to get permission from this and permission from that and permission from the, you know, and then the next thing will be, and their families may not want it. And so it might not just be that nice. So the first thing would be work out, and then the kids may not be up to it without having their teacher there to coach them. So it would take a lot of organizing. I think it would be lovely for all of them to do that.
But what do you feel is the value for a high school student to learn about the factory and the workplace?
Well, there are ways of doing that which might be more possible, but look what that worker said about how the people there were treating him as a little brother. It would be a very good place for learning if they were... You see, we have child labor laws, and for very, very good reasons, but sometimes the only education a kid is going to get will be if he or she can go and work next to their parent on the factory floor, and they'll get the education and they'll get the care. Maybe they won't get the mistreatment. But we've got such a prejudice against all of that. So I think that's the issue, that somewhere along there you can learn wonderfully from someone across the table. That was another one. I talked to an old tailor, and he said when he was a student and he would be working here cutting things, and there was the tailor there sewing things. And when he came to a difficult thing he was doing, he'd say, stop and watch what I'm doing. You can learn from this. And that kind of learning across the table where you're both working, I think is very good learning. And the child feels loved, amongst other things.
Did you work with your hands when you were young?
I did a lot of working with my hands because my school had a form of education of learning by doing. And in fact, the way I've taught studio was started, my mother did a lot of things like that. She was the electrician in the house, not my father. And she'd been an architect, so she was very involved with that. But also, I in the school, we had, you know, lots of schools now, they teach anthropology before history to little teenies because of anthropology is where do the children live and where do the parents live and how do they cook, and so, and that's all object oriented and pictures. So then what we were doing though is we were building primitive huts of different nations. So there was an Egyptian one, you see, which had a flat roof. There was a Mexican one, a Mexican-American one. There was a Zulu one. And I was with a team of about seven kids and this teacher. She's the player coach, the way Dave Crane used to be with us, and I was in the studio. So we're all trying to make a mud hut with mud walls and then a straw roof. And I've got pictures of that kind. So you start out with wattle tree trunks. Well, we didn't. We used nails and banged them into a plywood. So you bang the nail in, then you go to the next nail. And lo and behold, you bang the next one in and the first one pops out. So the end of that, I call it studio. We call it handwork, you see. And handwork became a center for history learning and all sorts of things. It's called learning by doing.
Experience. I did that too.
You did, yes.
I still remember in fifth grade or sixth grade lying on my back under my desk. We had to pretend we were Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel and mix the paints as well.
Yes.
So why do you feel it's important, or one of the issues I've been working on is how to bring manufacturing back to cities and why work is important in cities and to see the worker and to make them visible. And I'm wondering what your perspective is on that, on the idea that it's important to keep manufacturing in a city like Philadelphia, and what that does for also the diversity of the city and the kind of dynamic of a place like Philadelphia, even today.
Well, I can say things like that, but unless I know how, I can't say, as architects do, well, you should do that. You know, I was talking with one of these young people working with us now. He says, well, the answer that the students give always is, of course, people are going to love this architecture I'm doing so much that it will bring them there. And Of course, the social planners just roared with laughter at that notion. What makes you think you're so special that you can draw people for not very much reason? Mm. And so the same thing, yes, there ought to be. But unless we know very well the mechanics of it, I'm very proud when I see people sitting on the places, and I don't make seats, I make ledges, edges, things that they can say, ah, we can sit here. And they do. Mm-hmm. And I know why they do. Mm-hmm. And until I know why this working in the city is actually going to happen, I can't say it ought to happen. I can only say, let me see the mechanics of it. And the way I would start would be understanding the organized system and the disorganized system. You know, in Italy, for example, you put in a request for a telephone with the official agencies. And at the same time, you put in a request for a telephone with the black market agencies.
Exactly.
Be damn sure the black market will get it to you first. Mm-hmm. Well, what does that mean here? I'm not saying do something illegal, but what are the roots of that kind of possibility of employment in making things? And what's unrealistic? Trump has just recently said, we're going to make the wall out of solar panels. And then Mexico can make a little money out of them. And then people said to him, you know, have you ever realized that a wall has to be vertical and solar panels have to be horizontal? But he just knows we'll make a wall out of and that, that'll work. Right. Well, that's the kind of nostrums that I'm very against.
Right.
And so I don't know what to say. I do know that every time I go to a doctor, I talk to the paramedics. And I say, 10 years ago, were you in this field? And they say, no. And I say, how did you get the training? Well, there was this technical school in the New Jersey suburb somewhere that I went to. So the whole color of what work is in Philadelphia is changing because of the demographics. I'm very interested in community colleges, but when I talk to the people who are, they haven't thought of job ladders.
Right.
They haven't thought of getting in touch with the people who do need the jobs and describing them and saying what they need and working together. And so I'm much more, and when I say Levitt's acquiring and vertically integrating the building industry is to me more interesting than working out how to reduce the price of construction on the site. Because it seems to me it's the problem you need to solve in order to have the problem, the other problem. So your question is, how would it be a good idea? You'd first have to tell me where the openings are for that kind of use of your hands and doing things.
So one of the things that some of the manufacturers in Northeast Philadelphia keep talking about is that the youth really don't know about manufacturing jobs and how much money they can make. So manufacturing has become something that is much needed. So let's switch to architecture for a bit, as you just showed in some images. How did industrial architecture inspire you, and what was it that attracted you to it the way I've been attracted to it as kind of this inspiration for so many modern architects? And I'd love to hear
what you see, that's where it starts, because I start out from my mother. I'm an early modernist. You see, we built our house in 1934. From the age of two, I saw plans, and I knew that their source of inspiration was factories, because I learned architectural history from her. She would say, here's the way an architect would design a car. That would be in like 1938, drawing me a picture, which turns out to look like that Volkswagen that came out after the war, you know, big straight one. She drew a car like that and said, that's kind of... Well, they were all looking at factories, and they were very interested in factory manufacture. And then, of course, I also later read the critics like Joseph Frank, and he learned with Loos, who made fun of the whole thing of truth to the machine. And Joseph Loos has a wonderful... They wrote in parables. Loos did that, and then Frank followed. And so he talks about the architect let's see how he would approach making a shoe, because you see the factory, you must follow what the machine can do. So then you'd make it a right angle, because the machine could go up and down and sideways. Mm-hmm. So you make a shoe like that, and you make it all the same for left and right foot, and then you put padding in the places. And so it says, and after that, the grateful machine will take a much-needed rest. And the next thing he says is, the machine can do anything. So I'm very well aware of that critique as well. But I got the feeling of getting to love ugly things. Mm-hmm. And the feeling that someone has said there's room in heaven, a teeny corner of heaven, for those who believe in morality and the arts. Mm. Well, I say that there is a good moral reason for being a functionalist, learning from factories. I'm still doing that. My plans for Michigan, the things I did there, looking at that route from New York to Philadelphia, seeing how they worked. And that's where we got the whole idea of the duck and the decorated shed, looking at some of those factories there. And I'd been doing that in South Africa, and of course African housing, looking at how the Africans on the edges of big cities like Johannesburg acquired influence from the remnants of industry around them. So they made musical instruments out of tin cans, you see, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And got suburban imagery out of beadwork. It was very interesting, all those. And I loved those combinations. Now, taking a Coca-Cola bottle and covering it as if it were a gourd. And the purists were horrified, but I was well into my way of thinking as I did. And the factories were the contribution of the early moderns to that same kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. But then there also comes the point where you say there's something that you're pushed to do because it's really practical that way. And you look at it and it looks god-awful. And then Liu Kahn put it very well. He says, you hate it and you hate it and you hate it until you love it because it's the way it's got to be. Well, I absorbed that too into that same thing of factories. But then I began to say, there's other things, not only factories. There's Levittown that everyone hates and science that everyone hates. And then Bob and I began playing a game. I can like something worse than you can like. And it's all in the interests of producing relevant problems and solutions for the society by not viewing everything with alarm, by saying, for seeing some possibilities of some beauty and some ugliness.
Right. Or I always also say it's part of looking at what's there and appreciating what's there and really kind of enhancing what we have in front of us.
Well, again, as between what is and what ought to be.
Right.
And there's a whole philosophy of how far does the should the ought to be go from the is, and Le Corbusier's shining city on a hill is very, very far from the inner city in Philadelphia, and perhaps too far to make the one fit in the other, although we all had hopes. And then, you know, the Smithsons, they tried to build streets in the air, and that seemed like a good way of bringing the two together, getting the street life, but having it more dense by having it in the air. Then they found that unless you had the density of the actual street and all the stories of the building on that actual street, what happened was people got mugged up in those streets up in the air, and then they cut them all off. And it was a valiant experiment that didn't work.
And what about this the kind of issue in terms of sociology of having the workplace and the factory in the community, whether it's Philadelphia or Johannesburg, and the idea of having a community be around the factory, more than a company town, but integrated with the neighborhood. Have you looked at that issue?
Well, you'd have to tell me what kind of industry can do that these days. At the moment, I don't believe much can.
But when in some of your amazing photographs of Philadelphia, you show these working communities and the neighborhoods and the people and the idea that they could afford their own home. Could you describe what it was like when you first came to Philadelphia?
It was like that in 1890, and that's what I'm saying. That was the time when there weren't cars, that there were just the first trolleys, and there was a stationary community with children who were very happy to have these little factories. Now, the little factories became apartment buildings, and you know, the whole of Manayunk was like that. That's one other story that an old woman told me. She worked in a mill, and this was probably maybe even 1950 or 1940s, and she did the last silk ribbon in that mill. And when it was over, they all gathered around her, and her boss gave her a glass of champagne.
When you were first here, what was it that you saw, or what attracted you to some of the networks and social ecologies?
The local people working in stores and mom-and-pop stores and things like that, and many of those, some of are left, but if I go to 40th Street now, I don't think I'll find the beautiful little stores I used to eat at there now. It's probably mostly university buildings. But there are some retail of that way. There's a lot of institutional work, paramedical work. That's grand scale. And there's also working in institutions. I'm very interested in John Fry at Drexel, who's setting up buying from people in West Philadelphia rather than getting from all over the place. And setting up the people who can supply Drexel and the other places with supplies that they need. I think that's a powerful university managing to do some good for once in the community. But I still think the other thing is to work with the community colleges and provide the job ladders.
Exactly.
So it needs a lot of thought to get the community colleges not to become an end point for people because they didn't plan those career ladders very cleverly.
Right.